The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
They don't teach rhetoric per se in America as much as they should, although there's more of it now. I think, if I may boast, I think because of me. I think I have taught other teachers, other teachers have taught other teachers have taught students. I think there's more of appreciation for Elizabethan rhetoric than there ever was before.
Everyone's got their thing.
Everybody, and welcome to the Fanatics Lower Decks. That's Star Trek Lower Deck Run. I am Claire Kramer, one of your hosts, and I am here with my other amazing co-host, Mr. David Magadoff. Hi, David.
Oh, hello, Claire. What a lovely day it is to be talking wonderful Paramount Plus animated comedy shows with you.
It is certainly a lovely day, and this is episode 6. I don't know what the official title is, but it should just be called Quirk's episode, or like, we're happy to see Quirk, you know?
Yeah.
It was such a surprise to see him in there. What were your thoughts, David?
Well, the greatest part is that it's Armin Shimerman, who's our guest today, who is playing Quirk. So it wasn't just Quirk, you know, the animated figure. It was Armin Shimerman, the man, the myth, the legend himself, and he's going to talk to us today about his love of teaching Shakespeare, but we'll get to that in a second. Did it just put a big old smile on your face, Claire, when you heard him and saw him?
Well, first of all, he, you know, everybody always says, especially in Los Angeles, oh, you haven't aged a day since such and such marquee project. You know, his obviously would be Deep Space Nine. His voice literally has not aged one day since then. I mean, he's a well-established, renowned, not just actor, but teacher and, you know, thespian in general. And his voice is everything behind it in this episode that you would want. And, you know, Quirk, it was so fun to see the animation of that character who, you know, we've known for decades. I just loved every single thing about this episode.
You're gushing.
Favorite part, David? I have so many, but go ahead.
I got a bunch. I loved it at the very tip top when they're just circling in awe of the pylons. I just appreciated it in the intro. Just the slow burn. I always love the slow burn moments of just the USS Cerritos just sort of circling the pylons and just be in awe of them. That made me smile. I think my line of the episode was, which I hope you enjoy as well, Claire, when that guy was talking to Ensign Tendi, I've never been to Orion. I'm from Cincinnati.
There were a lot of good lines in this episode. One thing that has struck me now, you know, we've been in this on this Lower Decks journey 6 episodes in. It is definitely not a children's show.
I mean, no.
There are so many double innuendos and things like thrown in there, and you know, one in particular, I was like, I can't believe that made it on air. One term, which I will share offline. I don't want to even say it.
Just write it down, Claire, and hold it up to the screen.
Okay, I will. I'll type it on my phone and hold it up.
Yeah.
But it is definitely an adult show. And the more, it's one of those shows, like, I always say this about the movie Anchorman. Like, the more you watch it, the more you can appreciate the humor. The first time I saw Anchorman, I was like, yeah, it was okay. It was kind of good, but not one of the best of Will Ferrell's movies. But the more I've seen it, the more I'm like, that movie is freaking genius. And I kind of feel that way about Star Trek Lower Decks.
Yeah, it's a brilliant show. Mike McMahon we, as you all know, we don't have to be the first to say it. We certainly are.
Coke Zero, Mike McMahon.
175th. But yeah, he's amazing. But yeah, Armin was a pleasure. We loved having him on. He is, like I said, a true thespian. He's so kind. He was just so generous with his time. I loved, you'll probably hear it throughout the episode, how he was like, great question, Claire. Great question.
Right.
David.
I know. I personally felt like seen. So such affirmation.
It's like, you've been my dad. I'll take you as my dad. I'm fine with that. But yeah, he's a delight. Of course, you know him as Quark from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, obviously, and mm-hmm. from this wonderful show, BioShock, Ratchet and Clank Future, A Crack in Time, The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy.
The regular
so much
show.
He's done. Yeah. He is an absolute treat of a human being. And boy, he loves teaching Shakespeare. So I hope you guys all get to hear his passion come through. Enjoy.
Forsooth.
Armin, do you ever dream an iambic pentameter?
No. I do dream in rhetoric, but I do not dream an iambic pentameter. In fact, I don't much care for iambic pentameter.
Oh, I can't wait to get into that.
How long did it take for you to start dreaming in rhetoric?
50 years. 50 years of constantly reading Shakespeare, constantly reading about the period, constantly reading about what rhetoric is about.
Oh, wow. So quite the commitment. Today we're talking about Shakespeare and your love of teaching Shakespeare, which is exactly what this podcast is about. It's finding those niche things.
Right. Constantly reading this book.
He's holding up Shakespeare's Use of the Arts of Language. That is what he's holding in his hands.
Yes, by Sister Miriam Joseph.
What was your first exposure to Shakespeare? Were you very young? Were you in university? What was your first exposure to his work?
My first exposure to his work was in high school, where I was reading about him. But more importantly, I transferred schools. I went from New Jersey to California and enrolled in Santa Monica High School, where my teacher, a man named Jellison, Mr. Jellison, cast me as Claudius in the play Hamlet. Claudius is the king, of course. And I became fascinated with the language and with the characters. I then went on to UCLA, where I became an English major, and it was my forte was to study Shakespeare. I graduated with a degree in English with specialization in Shakespeare. And ironically, if I may tell this story for your Star Trek fans.
Please.
My primary Shakespeare teacher at UCLA was a man named David Rhodes. And David Rhodes is very important to Star Trek. I'll tell you why. David Rhodes periodically invited young British actors to come to UCLA to help teach Shakespeare to his English students. And he periodically brought people in. One of the times he brought people in, he brought in a young Patrick Stewart to help in the classes. Ironically, one of the producers, one of Roddenberry's producers on Next Generation, saw one of those classes. Don't know why he was there, but he did. And he went back to Roddenberry and said, I think I found the captain. And that's how Patrick, in a way, there are many roads to that to final hiring, but that's one of the roads that brought Patrick to Star Trek.
Wow. That's a good story. That's solid. That's not nothing. Armin, how did you know you wanted to teach this? Before you answer that, a bigger, more important question. Where did you grow up in New Jersey? I am also from New Jersey.
Oh, I grew up right in the middle of New Jersey, about 10 miles outside of Asbury Park, a little town called Lakewood, New Jersey, which is now a rather eccentric sort of place, and I won't go into that. But I had a lovely, lovely, lovely childhood and was brokenhearted when I left Lakewood to move to Santa Monica. However, I'm very, very grateful for that move to Santa Monica because it put me on the pathway to acting. I never would have been an actor if I'd stayed in Lakewood.
Not a big union in Lakewood. Yeah, I grew up in Monmouth County.
Toms River?
So... I was in Marlboro specifically. Red Bank, New Jersey was where
right on the shore.
That was where I'm like my childhood haunt was. So anyway.
So Red Bank, I went to Red Bank often to go to the beach. Asbury Park, Red Bank, Ocean City, they're all right there.
Yes, that was our Shakespearean tangent. So now I'm going to take you back to where did you learn to love to teach it?
Well, I originally didn't think much of being a teacher, but when things were tight in Los Angeles after I moved from New York, a friend of mine, Ellen Gear, who runs a Shakespeare festival in Los Angeles called the Theatricum Botanicum, asked me if I wanted to teach. And I said, Ellen, I've never taught. I don't know if I could be a very good teacher. This is probably back in 1982, maybe, perhaps then. And because of Ellen, I started to teach at Theatricum and found that it was a great passion. I loved watching actors realize what they didn't know about Shakespeare, about how to make the language clear, how to make a lot of things clear. And that eventually, from that beginning at the Theatricum, I expanded out and started teaching all over Los Angeles. I was asked, as I went away to do theater around the country, oftentimes theaters would ask me to do a seminar about Shakespeare, and I love teaching that. It is a great passion of mine to see the light bulb go on for actors when they realize what was perhaps difficult for them in the past was now clearer, more accessible for them, and they became better actors, better communicators at it. It is perhaps more than anything I do, it is the thing I love the most, besides my wife, that I adore doing, which is teaching Shakespeare.
When you were a student yourself and in Hamlet, how did you approach the language? Because often, as you've said, that's a barrier for many. Was it easily accessible to you from the beginning, or did you have your own light bulb moment?
No, of course not. I was a high school student. It was not accessible. It was very dense, and God knows what my performance was like. But I have found, and I've worked in many Shakespeare festivals across the country, I have found that many professional actors aren't much better than I was in high school. They may have more credits and other things, and they may have done a lot of Shakespeare, but they're not good communicators. And what I love doing is teaching actors to be better communicators, to make the language much more understandable. If I may, another example. Here's a line that everybody's heard 1,000 times. What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Now, if I sit down and ask a class, and I've been asking classes now for decades, what does that line mean? You've heard it 1,000 times. What does it mean? And they sort of have a sense of what it is. They're not quite sure what it is. But when I start to talk to them about the principles of rhetoric, something called antithesis, about opposites, or about things that I call juxtapositions, two things being compared to each other, the crux to understanding that line is to understand that what Romeo sees is the light coming out of Juliet's bedroom, and it's a faint light. And so he compares it to the east. And for us, for anyone who's knowledgeable, for those of us who had to get up early for makeup, for Star Trek, for instance, we saw many a sunrise. And the light from the sunrise is very dim compared to the noonday sun. So if you understand that the east is sunrise and the sun is midday, then if an actor knows that, he can make the comparison in his what's called specifics and make the line that much clearer. So instead of saying, what light through yonder window breaks, it is the east and Juliet is the sun, rather say it this way. What light through yonder window breaks, it is the east and Juliet is the sun. So you hear the juxtaposition, you hear the change. That is what I teach actors. And just as I saw your heads bobbing up and down, so I see it in class when the actors go, oh, oh. And then all of a sudden, the line becomes clear. It may not be 100% clear, but it's much clearer than it was before.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I get into it at the end of the pod usually, like, why, you know, do we, you know, why is it that you do what you do and why do you love it? But and you've kind of said it. Is it really just seeing someone's eyes light up because you get to share something in a way that they had not known something previously and now they do and they're better for it, happier for it, more enlightened for it? And that to you is literally like what you can sleep on your pillow at night with.
David, you put it much better than I ever could. It is that light, that happiness, that yes, they got it. And what's more,
You change someone.
I've changed someone, and what's more, if I see them in performance, I'm not bored with their performance because they actually have techniques now to communicate to me and the rest of the audience, and I can enjoy that production that much more because there are actors in it who know what they're doing. They teach this. They don't teach rhetoric per se in America as much as they should, although there's more of it now. I think, if I may boast, I think because of me. I think... I have taught other teachers. Other teachers have taught other teachers. Other teachers have taught students. I think there's more of appreciation for Elizabethan rhetoric than there ever was before. They teach this in England. And one of the bugaboos that I've been fighting all my life is the stereotype that English actors are better at Shakespeare than American actors. And I can tell you that that's not true. I've seen a lot of bad English actors.
So... how did you develop your teaching approach?
Gradually. Thank you, Claire. It was gradual because I hadn't taught before. It wasn't my métier. And I had to learn step by step, how do I do this to break through the fog of ignorance in my students? How do I...
Were you kind of louder and stricter at the beginning, or were you more like kind of in the corner?
I'm always loud and I'm always strict. I'm always very strict. And I've learned that the stricter I am, the better my students like it, because they need to be led by the hand in order to break through the scar tissue of bad teachers. One of the things that is really important to a Shakespearean actor is to leave your emotions behind. There are times when you have to be very emotional, but most of the time, for a Shakespearean performance to work, you must be less emotional and more cerebral. And the more cerebral you are, the easier it is for an audience to understand. Because unfortunately, when an actor is being very passionate on stage, it's great for the actor. He's having a wonderful time. It's a sexual experience for the actor who's in the midst of an emotional crisis. The problem is the audience hasn't the faintest idea what that person is saying. And they feel stupid. And that's what I'm trying to fight constantly. I'm trying to make the audience not feel stupid. Because when they feel stupid, they think they don't like Shakespeare. But if you give the audience a performer, or if they're just reading it, if they know the principles of rhetoric, if they're just reading it, then all of a sudden they can appreciate it that much more.
All right, I got a question for you, because Claire and I are actors and have taken many a Shakespeare class. And
I'm so sorry.
Just probably from someone not nearly as wonderful as you. And have you ever been in that classroom? I'm sure you have. So the answer is yes. So I'm just curious now, what do you do with it? Where there's always that one guy or that one girl who's just not getting it or doesn't care. Do you put all of your time and attention to there, and the other 99% of the students are like rolling their heads around waiting for you to be done? Or are you like, you know what? They don't get it. I'm going to really stick and work with the people who are excited about this. Are you able to let that guy or girl go who's like just chewing gum in the other side of the room? Is it just bothering?
As you describe it, David, those are two different types of students. One is one who doesn't care and one who doesn't get it. I mean, the one who doesn't get it may care, but isn't getting it. With that person who cares but doesn't get it, I give them more time. because mm-hmm. I want them to succeed. If it's someone who's joined this class, God knows for what reason, and they're bored to tears, yes, after I've realized there's no hope there, I move on to other students. But okay, if good. They have a,
you're a good
at
teacher.
All an interest, if they really want to learn, then I will give them extra time. And yes, the other students may roll their eyes, but that's too bad. They will learn from my spending time with the other person.
Okay, I want to call back for a minute because you said something really interesting about cultivating the performance so that the audience feels knowledgeable and included. So when you have cultivated that performance with a certain actor and gotten them to a certain place and you're watching, do you watch the audience or do you watch the actor?
That's a great question, Claire. Thank you. I invariably watch the actor. That's what an actor wants. He doesn't want you to look around. He wants you to be focused on his or her performance. So I give the actor my respect and I'm watching them. On occasion, if the actors are really bad, then I may look around at the audience because there's nothing to watch on stage and see, you know, what the response is. Usually it's boredom. If the actor is not communicating and the audience is beginning to think, I just don't understand this stuff, they get bored and they start to look around. And that breaks my heart because I'm truly in love with Shakespeare and the period. And I want people to be as excited about it as I am. After all, it is part and parcel of my success as an actor. Almost invariably, all the major actors on Star Trek have a classical background. And for me, certainly, without Shakespeare, I would not be sitting here in front of you.
Can you turn it around between Act One and Act Two if the performances are not resonating or connecting and they're not actually following the method that you've taught? Are you able, like a good coach, like Ted Lasso, to just turn it around in between acts?
No, that's against the law. You both should know that. You cannot. The director cannot talk to an actor during a performance. That's against union principles and bylaws. So you can't do that. And if the actor's not doing well that performance, then you hope that the next performance, you hope that rehearsal gave them enough of foundation so that if they're having a bad night, it will be better the next night. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no mound visits.
What's that, David?
No mound visits as a
right.
baseball.
Yeah, no visits to the mound. And you can't do that. Equity says directors can't do that.
So Armin, you brought up Star Trek, and I think it's a great question. So not every actor is a teacher, but you are an actor and you are a teacher. Was it difficult, or did you find ways because people were open to it potentially, or did you just go, no, that's not my time, I'm an actor here on set right now, when you'd be seeing performances of your fellow actors on set, you know, in Star Trek, would you ever want to say something or try to say something, or did you keep your mouth closed?
I kept my mouth closed, David. You get into a lot of trouble to talk to a peer about their performance. That's a huge no-no. I have worked with actors on Star Trek that I would love to have said something to, but that is a taboo, and I would never cross that. That is.
Do you go home and at least talk to the wife and just go like, this was an interesting day?
Yes, that okay. happened many times.
Good. You got to get it out somewhere.
And even usually she was asleep, however, when I came home.
Fair enough. Well, you're really a good listener when you're sleeping. No talk back. So would you ever come home from a class, say, like you've just taught at USC, my alumni. Would you come home from class and talk to your wife about it? Or do you journal about it? Or do you just sort of, when class is done, you're done and it's good? Or does it kind of sit with you if all of a sudden you made someone's day and you made a great revelation?
I often talk to my wife because my class was done at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So there was lots of time to talk to her after the class was over. And yes, if someone made a breakthrough, if someone didn't make a breakthrough, I would go home and speak to my better half and say, it really worked today. Or yeah, today wasn't much good. Because I am passionate about it, and keeping it bottled in is not good. And I tell the students too, when they do very well, and I see they've had a breakthrough, I'm jumping up and down. That's it. And if they're not, I'm going, you know, what the hell is wrong with you? Haven't I spoken this enough? Or I'll take to the class and say, can you all understand what I'm saying? Because this person can't. Can you tell him something? Maybe I'm putting it the wrong way. Maybe you can tell him or her what you understand that I'm not communicating to them.
Is Romeo and Juliet, because you mentioned the line from Romeo and Juliet, is that a entry point with your new students? Or what would you consider the entry point Shakespearean work? And what is the most difficult, like the ramp up that you have to really learn the method before you can tackle effectively?
A good question, Claire. So it's no secret that as Shakespeare progressed in his career, the lines and the structure of the lines became more dense, harder. Mm-hmm. The connective tissue is more present in the earlier plays than it is in the later plays. So Romeo and Juliet is a relatively early play. So that, like Richard III, for instance, those are easy plays to approach because the language is easier. When you get to Winter's Tale, when you get to The Tempest, when you get to Pericles, that's difficult language, especially Winter's Tale. That's difficult. So I usually don't assign work from the later plays until the latter part of my class, because you have to have the foundations, the technical things to approach that. That's my answer.
All right. This is a good one. What if you had to teach someone how to teach Shakespeare? Like, what's the one thing you would want that teacher to know?
Well, certainly I would want them to know the principles of rhetoric. I don't care tuppence about iambic pentameter.
Which we got to get into in a second, by the way, but keep going.
Sure, absolutely. But I would want them to study the fundamental principles of Elizabethan rhetoric. If you know those, then you can teach someone to be a better, and not just Shakespeare, to be a better classical actor. Because rhetoric was taught, it's still taught, but it wasn't the forefront of teaching for people, not just actors, but for people up until about the beginning of the 20th century. For some reason, rhetoric was taken out of the curriculum. And wasn't the focus. But for everybody, up until the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, rhetoric was in the forefront of their studies.
All right. Why do we hate iambic pentameter?
I don't hate iambic pentameter.
Why do you strongly dislike
it? Why do I dislike it? This is why I dislike it. Because bad teachers stress iambic pentameter.
Mm.
And the truth of the matter is, and there's been a lot of studies on this, that there's a huge proportion of Shakespeare's verse that is not in iambic pentameter. So if you try to force the verse to always be iambic pentameter, then you're going to lead people astray at times. And that's why I don't like iambic pentameter, because people are thinking, I've got to beat this out. Ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. Okay, now, there are times when it is valuable. If you need to know the correct pronunciation of something, perhaps iambic pentameter will lead you in the right direction. But let me give you an example. Okay, I have a dear friend, an actress. Her name is Tess Harper, an Academy Award nominee. She comes from the Ozarks. When we talk about coverage for her car, she'll say insurance. And I will say insurance.
Yeah. Jersey.
And Shakespeare's English, the way they pronounce the language, is closer to Tess's pronunciation of words than mine. But if we're looking at iambic pentameter, if I'm looking at it from the way I say it, the accent is on the shore, insurance. She will say insurance, and the accent is on the end. So unless you have OP, which is the original pronunciation, if you have that intrinsically in your head, then perhaps you can follow iambic pentameter better, because you know where the accent fell. But again, a good proportion of Shakespeare's verse is not in iambic pentameter. And most teachers who stress that and only teach that are depriving the actors, or the English students for that matter, of the correct way to look at the language.
I completely agree with that, because for me, I feel like, you know, when I was taught iambic pentameter, and, you know, as an acting student, that it was being taught as almost like a musicality. Like you started speaking in that way, and then you were on this like runaway train, and that's how everything was delivered. And there, it was emotionless for me. So I went through a phase where I just didn't even want to do any Shakespeare because I wasn't connecting to any of the words. It was just this cadence that was being pushed, you know?
Right. And so that the sound becomes more important than the meaning.
Right. Than the meaning. And then
meaning is what's really important. Meaning is what's important.
So I completely agree with your philosophy of like almost just throwing that out and just approaching it from the juxtaposition makes a lot of sense. When you said that, I'm like, oh, That's almost every line. You can find that dynamic, you know, the light and the dark, the high and the low. So anyway, that's me, Armin, saying you have taught me something now in podcast.
It is that. And then the way he wrote also changed in the sense that in the early plays, the thoughts often ended at the end of the verse line.
Mm-hmm.
But in the later plays, there's a lot of run-on stuff. And take the Scottish play, for instance, a lot of the ideas end in the middle of the line.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're following iambic pentameter, you'll be cheated of those real endings that are.
Well, you're going to hit it down instead of open.
That's right.
You mentioned on Star Trek, many of the actors are classically trained. I went myself through NYU and the program there, but it's becoming more prominent for actors not to have that classical training and to just sort of enter into the business. And you can certainly be successful that way. Why is Shakespeare still relevant to a young student?
Because of language, because if you get some good writers in film and TV, they'll be using the same principles, whether they know it or not, as of rhetoric. I mean, one of the great quotes of all time is John Kennedy, think not what your country can do for you, but think what you can do for your country. That's enormously rhetorical because of the repetition of words and the structure of things. And in films and in TV, certainly in Star Trek, a lot of science fiction, a lot of good TV, the writing is really essential. I mean, the producers are the writers. They are the forefront of the program. And if you can handle language correctly, doesn't have to be Shakespeare, just language. If you can appreciate language and how to use it in an artistic way, then you are not only a better actor, but you are a better communicator, and your audience will appreciate it as well.
All right, Armin, if you had to teach something that wasn't Shakespeare, what would you teach? Or that's it, one and only.
My one and
great.
Only.
That's an answer.
I guess I would. That's. I'm flummoxed. That's it.
Beautiful. Great. Then you've picked the right thing.
Yeah.
Well, because I like that question because it's, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, the topic is obviously teaching Shakespeare. And some people might say that's my favorite thing to teach, but I just love teaching. And some people might, like you, like, I love Shakespeare, so teaching it's a beautiful thing. But yeah, I don't really love teaching necessarily.
I have been asked many times to help actors with non-Shakespearean auditions or non-theater auditions. And I turn them down. I go, I won't be good for you. You get yourself a better teacher than that.
Know thyself.
If it's a classical or a theatrical piece, yes, I can do that. But if it's a TV audition or a film audition, there are much better teachers than I am for that.
Great.
What do you do with when two students are engaged in a scene and one is absolutely, you know, just being genuine and understanding and one is not? Do you switch scene partners or do you utilize the one that's actually understanding the technique to pull it out of the other?
Well, one of the things I was taught, perhaps you were as well, that all life comes from the other actor. So to focus on one without the other is an anathema. So you try to bring the lesser of the two up a notch or two to give their scene partner, you know, more life. I tend to focus on the person that hasn't matriculated as quickly as the other. If that proves to be undoable, then yes, I think I will switch scene partners and say, well, that's great. You guys have completed this scene. Thank you very much. Now move on to something else. Get yourself another scene partner. because you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
Okay, last question before we get to our love letter.
I have one more after this.
Second to last question before
penultimate. The penultimate question.
The penultimate. Thank you.
Yeah, the martini shop.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any students who you've kept in touch with now over the years, or they've kept in touch with you? Does that give you great joy, or do you just like mic drop out of a class and you don't need to see them anymore?
I've been fortunate enough that all my USC students have tried to keep in touch with me. I just had coffee with one the other day.
Oh, great.
They are finding that what they learned in school was very valuable, but of course, life after school is a totally different animal. And they appreciate what they learned, but they also want to know more. And in that case, because I am a fairly successful actor, they want to know about that as well. Putting Shakespeare aside, they want to know about agents, about managers, sure, about auditions, about all sorts of things. What do they do? So they've been very good about keeping in touch with me, and I'm very happy to talk to them. I have a lot of students. I've been teaching for over 30 years. I have a lot of students, and I'm very gratified when many students will come up to me and say, you know, I had to give up on my acting career, but I became a teacher, and I teach a lot of what you taught me.
Oh, cool. I mean, one of my favorite teachers, his name's Eric Truels. He's since retired. He taught improv and solo performance at USC, and he was a hard ass, but in the best possible way. So
I hope that's what I am as well.
Yes, maybe. Armin, I can almost know that I would have been one of those students of yours asking you to coffee, because I really respond to people who are direct but loving, and that sounds like what you do. So that's awesome.
Thank you.
Well, my last question before the final love letter is, you know, how important is it in teaching your students to teach about the man himself behind the sonnets and plays? How much of that influences the work, and how much is that obsolete?
I don't think the man himself, teaching about the man, is very important. However, I do think knowing what all of mankind was thinking, feeling at that time is enormously important. I truly believe that William Shakespeare wrote the plays, and I can give you reasons at another time for why I believe that. But if somebody else did write the play, and we've recently found out through scholarship that perhaps Marlowe had a lot to do with the Henry VI plays, it doesn't matter to me who wrote the plays. What matters to me is the communication of the ideas in the plays to a modern audience. I am interested in Shakespeare for my novels. I write novels about a young Shakespeare. But per se, and I'm fascinated to read about Shakespeare, but it rarely comes up in my teaching.
Mm.
All right, Armin, this has been an absolute delight. For those of you, like again, who just can't get enough Shakespeare, go to that Kim Rhodes episode we did. But today, Armin, you gave us another view of the great bard. Can you please regale us with a love letter?
Yes. Dear teaching Shakespeare, thank you for decades of satisfaction, of learning, of enjoyment, of solving puzzles, of watching actors get better at their craft. It is an enjoyment, it is a pleasure, it is a blessing, and thank you, thank the gods for putting me on this path, because it has given me great, great, great joy. Love, Armin Shimerman.
Beautiful.
Fantastic. I'm coming to you, Armin, next time I have a Shakespearean audition, which I don't know when that will be.
Well, if you do, give me a call. I'm happy to do it. My rates are very low, by the way.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Yeah, it's a funny one. What kind of teaching style you like? I mentioned it in the episode, but, you know, I always tended to gravitate to teachers who were kind of a hard ass, but I always liked that personally because I felt like they cared. Now, obviously, that can go a bad way and they can be mean or a bully or whatever. But I often found that the teachers that were hard asses in my experience, they also had to have a quality about them that I knew they were being hard because they cared so much versus they were just mean, like just mean teachers. I don't know how you felt. Did you respond to teachers like that, Claire, at NYU? Or were you like, don't even think about talking to me that way?
Well, the interesting thing about NYU is you do 2 days at the university for your academics, and then you do 3 days out at a studio. So I didn't actually study acting at NYU. I studied acting at Lee Strasberg Theater Institute and had my academics at NYU. But in terms of teaching style, I mean, for both acting and academics, I was always like a front row student. You know, I like to get there, take my notes, do my thing. So I resonated with a teacher that was articulate and a clear communicator more so than like, you know, a strong particular teaching style. And then at Strasberg, all the teachers that I studied under there, which you studied music and Tai Chi and dance and also acting. And the acting classes were 4 hours long, 3 times a week. And those teachers were direct students under Lee Strasberg. So they were all a little bit older, had been teaching many, many decades. And only recently, since they've started to, you know, pass away or retire in their 70s and 80s, have people who haven't directly studied under Strasberg begun to be allowed to teach at Lee Strasberg Theater Institute. So there was a very particular style that was taught there. Even though the teachers were very different in personality, the format was the same, which is, you know, what is considered method acting. So I don't know. What was your like training as an actor like?
Oh my gosh. I went to USC. I had a good time. I'd say though, kind of in a funny, similar way to you, like you went to NYU, but you went, they said, hey, go to Lee Strasberg. This is how we teach you guys how to act. You know, we kind of, they export you to a studio, which is under the NYU umbrella. Similarly, I did a semester abroad in London at BADA, the British American Drama Academy. And that really was just like the semester of all semesters where I didn't even think I wanted to be an actor. And then I did the semester. And by the end of it, I was like, I think I'm going to try this thing like to as a profession. So who knew? You know, I who knew? But that's what the experience was for me. And to circle back to what Armin said, just to put a cap on the feather here, he said, you know, a lot of people think naturally that British actors do Shakespeare the best. But it was really fun hearing from all of my British professors say to us young American kiddos, hey, you guys actually do Shakespeare in a way that we typically really enjoy more. So it's funny. So they were all like, no, we really like how Americans do Shakespeare. Like, and they weren't giving us BS. I could tell they really meant it. So that was kind of cool. So it's just a nice reminder that Shakespeare is for everyone and for every language, and what a beautiful thing. So speaking of beautiful things, podcasts. The Fanatics Podcast. Enjoy all these episodes, friends. If you loved the Shakespeare one, like you did today, go back to Kim Rhodes. Like I said, she gave a heartfelt, beautiful podcast about her love of just Shakespeare and just the language. So You will get it from all angles, my friends, the love of the bard. And you have a gift waiting for you to unwrap. Feel free to like, subscribe, share all the things. And we'll see you next Thursday for a brand new episode like we do.
David is correct.
Before I let you guys go, let me tell you a little bit about next week's episode. We have on Mr. Eugene Cordero from Star Trek Lower Decks. It's still going on, guys, on Paramount Plus Season 3. And you know him from Easter Sunday, Kong Skull Island, Little Demon, the new animated show, Tacoma FD, Loki, and of course, like I said, Star Trek Lower Decks. And he's going to talk about his favorite British reality TV shows. Isn't that fun? So grab a cup of tea and join us and line up in the queue. Just kidding, there's no queue. It's a free episode. Click play. Enjoy. See you next Thursday.
Thank you for listening to Fanatics, a Roddenberry podcast. For more episodes and info, head over to wearefanatics.com or tweet your Fanatics thoughts and stories at wearefanatics.
Yes, that's We Are F-A-N-A-D-D-I-C-T-S. Our show is hosted by Claire Kramer and me, David Magadoff.
Produced by me, Claire Kramer, and Kelsey Goldberg. Executive producers Trevor Roth and Rod Roddenberry.
Our sound engineer and editor is Elizabeth Joy Windham. And you can thank Stephen Mudd for our theme song.
Catch us next Thursday for another Fanatics episode.
I don't like iambic pentameter. I don't like it very much at all.
Just give me some of that rhetoric.